those searchlights up on the tower. Right now. Move! Move!
I listen to 2ARM, 92.1 FM, in the car and at work, for great tunes and community news.
Hello, I'm Herb, and welcome to Community Spotlight. Every week I invite a person or an organisation to come in and talk about their life or their event. And today I have Colin Bale. Good morning, Colin.
Good morning, Herb. Good to be with you.
Thanks for coming in on this little bit chilly morning, but lovely sunny day in Armidale.
Yes. Lovely frost across the valley in front of us today, yes.
A difference from the rain we've had over the last how many weeks? I can't remember.
Oh, yes.
So tell me, Colin, where were you born?
I was born in Wingham, which is in the Manning Valley, and a place that's just had terrible, terrible floods.
Was there any floods when you were growing up there?
Well, I do remember it coming over the railings of the old wooden bridge one time, yes, as a tiny little tacker.
And you went to Nambucca Primary and Maxville High School?
I did, yes. We moved to Nambucca when I was 5, so I did primary school there, and in those days there was no high school in Nambucca Heads, so bus to Maxville every day.
What was growing up in Maxville and Nambucca Heads like?
Oh,
it was idyllic.
Growing up in Nambucca was like being on holidays every day.
Oh, nice.
You wore your swimmers under your school uniform, and after school just went straight to the beach, and that was it.
Fantastic. And then you finished year 12 and then you went to uni.
I did. Started to get a bit serious, and the closest uni to Nambucca was University of New England, and that's where I went.
You did a science degree.
Yes, I did. I majored in plant science through the Department of Botany, as it was then.
And you went and did a postgrad?
Yeah, there were a couple of guys there who really impressed me, a couple of lecturers, a guy called John Williams and a guy called Jim Charlie, and they offered to joint supervise me in a forest ecology project, and so, yeah, that took up the next few years.
And you finished your PhD in about 1980?
I did, yes, I did.
So tell me, go back a little bit in time, tell me what it was during your growing up that triggered you to enter a science career.
Yeah.
Was there one thing that you can think, I know what mine was.
Yeah.
What was yours?
One of my old school teachers, when he heard I was doing science, he couldn't believe it because he thought I'd do economics at university. Yeah, growing up, my father was an outdoors guy. He used to like going out to a little spot called Yarrahappini, actually. It's just south of Maxville. Beautiful, beautiful bit of forest, and he used to love going out there and just walking around the creeks and whatever, and me and my brother used to go with him, and that was the start of it, I think. We just loved the bush growing up, yep.
I think I have almost identical experience of why I went into ecology.
Oh, right.
And a career in that field.
Yeah.
You finished uni, or maybe you're still at uni, and you did some teaching.
Well, yeah, during my time at the university, especially post-grading, I was doing a fair bit of tutoring at the university and a little bit of lecturing. When I completed those studies, I did actually have a research position for a little while at the university, which was based on Fraser Island, which was a real hoot. I couldn't believe you get paid for working on Fraser. But that was only short-term money, and then I moved into teaching, got a job at the local TAFE College, teaching in biological sciences. I was the main plant science, ecology and laboratory techniques kind of person.
So the lab tech course back then, from what I remember, was your pathway into university if you didn't have a HSC or you didn't get too well with your HSC?
Well, it was called Diploma of Applied Sciences, and it was very similar to first and the first year science and some of second year science as well in terms of the degree. And in fact, students who went through the diploma could actually get some advanced standing at the university. They got most of first year university off. So it was a reasonably common thing for people to come through and do that. I mean, some people saw TAFE as, you know, second chance kind of stuff. And it was for some people. But for other people, it was exactly what they wanted to do. They wanted to be a technical person, a science technical person. And the applied science diploma was the qualification for that. And there's still people all over the western end of the university, all over the science end of the university, whom we taught. They're still there. The scary thing is some of them are retiring. Makes me feel old, but there you go.
Yes, retirement comes to us all.
It sneaks up, doesn't it?
Yep, I've recently retired after 30 years in that field. Tell me about the TAFE back then. So we're going to talk about the university and how it's changed. So we're talking the 80s through the 80s?
I'd say the 80s were some of the high times for TAFE New South Wales in terms of the amount of traction they got in the community as an institute, because there are a lot of the professional courses, as our diploma course was, many others in secretarial studies and business and so on, lots of professional courses, and of course the trades, auto and building and all of that. But there are also a lot of night courses happening in TAFE in those days. And whilst they weren't aimed at any professional outcome, they were aimed at people learning skills, whether it be coming in at night learning with woodworking tools or perhaps a lot of stuff to do with soft furnishings or all kinds of hobby courses. We used to run a hobby course in national parks, and we call it a hobby course, but it was actually life-changing for some of those people who came and did the night courses, because it gave them a whole new area of life to invest their time and sometimes to actually pursue a career later on, to do further study and pursue a career. In those days, you couldn't get a park anywhere around that block where the TAFE building is. It was packed out at night back in those days.
So I know that there's been a lot of building development on that block where our TAFE is. Mm. Does that mean that there's still a lot on offer at the TAFE, or it's changed its path, or what is it today, I wonder?
Well, I haven't been there for 12 years, I think, but they certainly have invested a lot in the learning hub, the digital learning hub, which is one of those new buildings, and its reach is quite considerable in terms of the amount of, shall we call it, online kind of learning that's available through there, yeah.
So where do people, if they want to do their soft furnishing course or things like that, do they look at the men's shed, or they look at woodworkers over at the showground to find out about woodworking? Where do they go if those things aren't offered anymore at TAFE?
Well, for a select few things, yeah, they probably were picked up by others, and I know men's shed were doing some little power tool kinds of and woodworking kinds of skills, but some of those courses just disappeared. The National Parks course just disappeared. And I know that some of the local groups like National Parks Association and the Growing Australian Plants groups do cover some of those areas in terms of, you know, conservation and plant science, but they don't cover it directly as the old course used to do.
Yes, I suppose my thinking of it is we just mentioned the men's shed, but, you know, there's the splinter group, which is the woodworkers. I suppose you, if you're interested in doing some of those particular interest type courses or get an understanding or some learning, you might go to the Armadale Tree Group and volunteer there to learn about plants, have some of their field days, do that type of thing. You know, you mentioned the National Parks Association, joining that, there's bushwalking, there's a few others. So I suppose the take up of those people into those interest type courses might be in volunteer organisations now.
Yes, there are some options, as you say, and it's very good that they are available. I think the point that I was making, though, that TAFE just changed direction in the 90s and removed a lot of the community-based training opportunities and moved specifically into more vocationally oriented things. That was the political and educational decision.
And you did mention the online with the current learning hub.
Oh,
so
yes.
Well, let's just jump to the university. Now, I know my time at the university in the geography and planning faculty and in the natural resource faculty, there was full classrooms, there was full lecture theatres, but I don't think we have that now at the university with the online focus.
Well, that depends on the particular course. Some courses you absolutely have to attend. Some of the courses, though, are offered entirely online, or almost so. My experience there was in the late noughties. I taught in science education for a little while there. Some of the students who were doing science education, I never met them. They were either overseas or they were in some remote part of Australia, and they weren't required to come to the intensive schools. It was great for those students who did come to the intensive schools to meet them and to give them opportunity of practicing their skills in front of their peers and learning together. We had little bush activities and that sort of stuff as well for the science education group. During those years, though, that I was at the university, it really did change. The focus very much was changing to online education during those 3 years, at least for the school that I was in.
So I suppose I'm not wanting to bag the university for changing that direction. It's just part of the change and technology that was sort of sweeping over the thing. But I suppose at the other side of it, having my kids go through university, and it is a different place now, the university, than it was. And as we get older and have experienced yes. that other life, the yes. university, the bistro and all yes. that happened, we can bemoan what it used to be like. Yes.
Absolutely. I think there's some obviously positives and negatives. It gives access to so many people who, for reasons of remoteness or other, mobility, whatever, simply would struggle with face-to-face on-campus education. That's a wonderful thing that people have that opportunity. But there is, for me at least, the loss of all the facing your peers kind of stuff, all the interactions that happen when you're learning together and living together, either on campus or in town, whatever. There's the real collegiality of doing those sorts of things is really important, especially in some of the courses and some of the activities that you do, yes.
Yeah, I think it certainly built a community environment yeah. at the university. You had your community environment in town, but seeing the same faces in the lecture theatre, I was a mature age student, so I met a lot of younger people that were going through, and it was just a great time. Yes. Probably spent too much time at university.
Well, yes. Well, I mean, this university was built as a little Oxford. I mean, that was yeah. the model at why we have so much residential capacity on campus. That whole idea of living together and learning together was obviously the Oxford model to some extent. And
yeah, I think it was successful.
Absolutely.
Now, I built a family at those times, in the 90s and 2000s. You did the same?
Yes, with my wife, we had three lovely kids who grew up and went through Duval High School and Newling Primary School before that, and very much valued the educational opportunity they had here and, of course, engaged in community activities with their peers, especially with music, which all three children were very much committed to and still are.
So you mentioned music. Let's just jump away from the sciences into music. Beechwood Music Studio, 2006. Now tell me about Beechwood Music Studio.
Oh, dear. Back in the 70s, I was working with country gospel outfit Richard and Shirley Pierce. I was their bass player, and they were recording with Eric Scott in Hadley Studios in Tamworth. And I played on a few of their albums during the late 70s, and the whole process of recording was just so attractive. The whole thing I loved it. And I thought, one of these days, I'm going to do that. And so over the years, I did invest a fair bit of time, and later on, rather too much money, building a little studio just out of Armidale on a property beside my house. And yes, that's Beechwood Studio, and it's quite a nice little facility for recording music, do a little bit of recording long form news, the occasional jingle, that sort of stuff, and audiobooks. Got a fair bit of audiobook work.
Oh, nice. We might talk about that off air. I've got some things in the pipeline on that theme. So you basically, people come in, I've seen a number of CDs. I know the Beardy Brothers, I know Cyril Green, our own Cyril Green,
yeah,
you've recorded Cyril.
Yeah.
And I know when I look on the back of a CD of particularly local musicians that you often see Beechwood Studios listed there. So you did the Beardy Brothers, I said, and you did Cyril. Who else? I know I'll put you on the spot now. You probably won't be able to think of anybody.
I've done a whole range of guys. Probably Jimmy Little is probably the biggest name I've done. But that wasn't actually an album release. That was a collection of material he wanted to do for Redfern Radio, which was quite successful, as I understand. And Jimmy was under contract to somebody else at the time, so he wouldn't have been allowed to release it formally. But it was used on Redfern Radio.
Just before you go off, Jimmy, now, how did you find Jimmy Little? Because I talked to Cyril about Jimmy, and he said he was just such a gentle, lovely man.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Thoroughgoing gentleman, yes. I met Jimmy through Cyril, because Cyril was the lead guitarist for that little country gospel outfit that I mentioned, recording in Tamworth. That's where I met Cyril. He turned up in the studio. I was the bass player. He was the lead guitarist. And we've been great mates ever since 1976 because of that, Cyril and I. Mm. lovely, lovely man himself.
No, definitely, and he has a great connection here with the station, coming in from time to time with Hazel and having a chat. It's great.
Yes, he does.
What else goes on at Beechwood? So audiobooks, is it everybody that just wants to be recorded come in, or what else do you do at Beechwood?
We do singles, we do albums, that kind of stuff. At the moment, I've got Pete Stanley, a local legend, human jukebox or whatever you want to call him. He sings all over the place in town and Tamworth and so on. Pete's got so many songs in his head that he's written that he just has to come out every year or two and, as he says, get them out of my head, Colin. Let's get them out of my head. And so he turns up with all these kind of songs, and then we go through track by track and build his album. And we're doing that just at the moment.
So you might mention to Pete, his father has a lot of poems, poetry. So that would actually fit into an audio book really well. And I was thinking maybe how we could use it in the radio station. But if you recorded some of those poems in an audio book...
Yeah,
Pete could certainly read them. And I think his brother's got a lot of them as well.
Right.
We could get a collection of poetry from the Stanley family.
Well, yes, because I do know Richard, the younger brother, and he is very likely to have some of those poems, and I think he writes some himself as well.
So, yeah, the Stanley family poems.
We'll work on it together.
We'll work on it together. It'll be collaborative. You're still doing the Beechwood Studios?
Yes. And I get all kinds of stuff from the Pub Rockers. I've got Axman booked in next month. Axman are the legends in town as well, legends of rock. And the Warts from Urala, they're a little bit harder edged. Punk rock. I like to call their stuff intergalactic rock, actually, because it's got all these... They're so inventive with their sounds, the swooping guitar sounds that just sweep all through these thumping rhythms.
But so it might fit a progressive rock genre.
It's almost prog, yes. Almost prog rock, yes.
So let's jump away from music to plants again.
Plants, right here.
Plant science. Now, I know from my good friend Greg Roberts that Antarctic Beach at Cathedral Rocks have been an important thing for you. Why is that?
Oh, look, Antarctic Beach as a species is an important thing to me. When I did my honours back in the 70s, Antarctic Beach was on the plots in New England National Park where my research plots were, and I got to really respect the species back then. Then during the 90s and noughties, I did a lot of work and published on Antarctic Beach as a sideline to my lecturing at the time. I kind of parked a lot of that stuff when I retired and got on with some other projects that I wanted to on my property, building my wife a garden and various things that I've done. And then in the drought of 2019, at the end of that drought, we had those horrific fires. The Gyra Road fire in particular was the one that really hurt east of us, and it burnt out Cathedral Rock National Park pretty much entirely. I got a phone call from some of my friends in National Park and the Park Service, and they said, can you come out and have a look at a little patch of beech forest with us, because it's been entirely burnt out and we believe you've worked on it, which was true. I had worked on it. I had a look at that site back in the 90s, which turned out to be a very good thing, because I had a bench line of what it should look like, and it absolutely broke our hearts to see this small patch of rainforest, which hardly anybody knows about, within or the eucalypt forest of Cathedral Rock National Park. And it was burnt to a crisp, not a leaf left on the rainforest at all, completely burnt out. So we have spent the last 5 years working on that, volunteer kind of effort really, but with a lot of support from National Parks and a couple of people in particular from National Parks who have helped us no end with that little project. It's almost a citizen science project, I suppose. But the outcome of it is that we are restoring that little patch of rainforest, and the big challenge, of course, will be keeping fire out of that, looking into the future.
The big thing about that fire was we'd come out of the back end of a big, long drought, and everything was so dry. Rainforest areas would probably not have burnt as hotly as it would have without that drought. Yes. Being the impact. And looking across the landscape, I remember flying a helicopter over there and just being so shocked at how much of that rainforest was gone. But you did find a new little patch just recently, is that correct?
Oh, we found a new patch of seedlings.
Oh, seedlings.
Seedlings, yes.
And I think you were taking some covers out to cover them to stop the roos eating them.
Oh, yes. The pressure that are on seedlings pretty much anywhere out in the forest. It's very dangerous being a seedling, in my view, because the seedlings that we have had of Antarctic beach, and Antarctic beech does not produce flowers every year. It's what's called a mast seeder, and so it only seeds maybe every third or fourth or fifth year. I refer sometimes to it as a lazy species. It's not quite so, but it seems like it's lazy in that it does not put in the effort to flower and fruit every year. However, straight after the fires, a few of the surviving trees actually put out new leaves because they had none. They put out a new little canopy and flowered. We got 148 seedlings from that flowering event. But within a year or so, all the seedlings, or nearly all the seedlings, had started to disappear, and we were wondering why. So we put a lot of effort into looking at the survival of the seedlings. Of course, being in the wrong spot was the part of the problem. If they were just growing on a bit of moss on a rock, well, the seedling didn't have much future, because as soon as the moss dried out, the seedling died. And a few of them were lost to that. However, a lot of the losses were either through herbivory, just being eaten off, probably swamp wallabies and other things, but the swampies, I think, were probably what did it. And then we also realised that a lot of seedlings had been dug up and scratched out or buried by scratchings. And I hate to say it, but it was the wretched lyrebirds doing it. I mean, they didn't know any better. They're just scratching through looking for, you know, their tucker, worms or snails, whatever they're looking for. And so they were just unwittingly destroying a lot of the seedlings that were really important to the future of the rainforest. So we put steel guards around all the seedlings, yes.
So I think Antarctic beech should be a particular community spotlight. There's a whole lot to talk to you about Antarctic beech. So we might leave it here with this community spotlight and come back at some time in the future, maybe 6 months' time, 8 months' time, after all this rain that we've had and your seedlings that you've covered and all that type of stuff. And we'll just shine the community spotlight on Antarctic beech and maybe Cathedral National Parks and other parks where Antarctic beech is found on the tablelands. Would you be up for that?
I certainly would. The species has actually, what we've been doing has actually generated a whole lot of stuff. Botanic Gardens in Sydney has picked up on it and done a genetic study. Mount Tomar Botanic Gardens is now sending their staff out to sample several hundred trees across the range so that they can grow them in Mount Tomar Botanic Gardens, basically as an ark. Basically, they have the gene pool all stored there at Mount Tomar as a safety mechanism, so that, for example, if Cathedral Rock gets burnt again, we will probably lose that patch entirely, and that gene pool will be gone. So Mount Tomar are coming. In fact, they're coming late this month, sending staff out to Cathedral Rock to do that. So that's worth another conversation, yes.
No, I think that's where we're at. So we will pull it up there, Colin. Thanks very much for coming in. And I'm glad that you've said on air that you will come in and talk to Antarctic beech, because what I didn't get to is what the importance of Antarctic beech is in the ecosystem's lens. So we'll talk about that in 6 or 8 months' time. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure.
You're one of our community members. You're one of our gems in our community, and that's Community Spotlight.
Broadcast, then podcast. If you missed it or want to hear it again, then visit our webpage, 2arm.net.au/podcast. I listen to 2ARM, 92.1 FM, in the car and at work, for great tunes and community news.